Welcome to the Epigenetics Podcast from Active Motif. Join host Dr. Stefan Dillinger for lively discussions with leading epigenetics researchers. Hear about their past experiments, what they're working on now, and what's coming next. You know their papers, now get to know them and discover the stories behind the science.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Epigenetics Podcast. Today I'm happy to welcome Upasana Sharma from UC Santa Cruz on this show. Please let me briefly introduce you to our audience. You got your PhD from Wesleyan University in Middleton in 2012. You then moved on to do a postdoc at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. And in 2018, you moved to University of California, Santa Cruz as an assistant professor. And you are still there today. A question I like to ask every guest to start off our little podcast is, how did you become interested in biology in the first place and then in pursuing a career in science?
Yeah, so I think for me, I got interested in biology, I would say, as soon as biology became a real subject in school. So that was one subject I could relate to the most. I was learning about how our bodies work, and I found that very exciting and very cool, how complex the system was. And so after high school, so when it was time to go for undergrad, I decided to do my bachelor's in science with honors in zoology. So in India, we have this honor system where you basically focus on one subject more than the others, so kind of major as we have here. And I think it was during that time when I took more advanced courses in molecular biology, genetics, you know, cell biology, that kind of solidified my interest in further studying biology and pursuing my higher studies in this area. So I decided to do master's again in zoology with a focus on cell biology. And during my undergrad, I got a chance to do a summer internship at a university. So the college where I went, we didn't have research labs on campus. So I went to a university to do the summer internship. And I think that was kind of my first hand experience of being in a research setting, learning how the whole process of research and discovery works, which was super exciting to me. And I wanted to do that in some capacity. But I would say for any, you know, students that would listen to this, it wasn't at that time that I knew what I wanted to do, but I kind of continue to pursue what I enjoyed doing at that time. So after master's, I took a 1 year off, did random jobs and tried to figure out maybe do an MBA. But somehow none of that fit what I really was excited about. So finally, I decided I'll do a PhD and, you know, continue my research journey. And so that's how I got into PhD. And then after PhD, postdoc, I still wasn't sure until maybe towards the end of my postdoc whether I want to, you know, have academic career and open my own lab. And so it was kind of doing things that I enjoy doing. It slowly became more clear what really is my, what works well for me. And that was more towards the end of my postdoc. And I thought I'll apply. I didn't know I'll get a job, but thankfully I was able to find jobs. And so I'm happy where I am now. But it was not a well thought about journey or this is what I'm going to do. It just kind of, I continued doing what I enjoyed doing.
And taking the next logical step, right? So master's.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk about your science and what you're doing now. And your science centers around understanding the mechanism of intergenerational epigenetic inheritance. But let's start at the beginning of your research career. During your PhD, you worked on H2AZ. In the first paper, you looked at H2AZ functions at the telomeres of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Can you talk about the study, how you got into that and what you found ultimately?
Yeah, so this was, you know, in my PhD in Dr. Scott Holmes's lab, where it was known at that time when I started my PhD that cell cycle progression through cell cycle is required for establishment of silent chromatin, so transcriptional silencing in yeast, which is known as silencing, which could be equivalent to heterochromatin formation in other model organisms. So the question was, what are the regulatory factors which are involved in this cell cycle requirement for establishment of silencing? Using yeast, which is a great system where you can do a lot of genetic manipulations, much more easy now that I work with mice. I know how easy it is to work with a yeast. So that was awesome. And we were able to identify three factors, H2AZ, SAS2, which is a histone acetyl transferase, and then a subunit of cohesin, SSC1, which had a negative regulatory role in establishment of silencing. So in other words, these factors, so at that time, the common thought or hypothesis in the field was that there are certain factors which positively regulate establishment of silencing. However, our work showed that it was this negative regulation, so that once these factors are dissociated from chromatin, for instance, H2AZ, that allows establishment of silencing at these telomeres. So that was really nice for me as a graduate student to do a lot of this genetic studies and molecular studies. And what we found, the two factors we found, the H2AZ and SCC2, was a nice kind of a, I should say, not an expected result, especially a cohesin subunit playing a role in establishment of silencing. So, yeah, so that was kind of the main gist of what we found in that paper.
So how does it work then that you have to go through replication to do silencing? I mean, is it because of the diffusion of histone marks, or is it because it finally opens up or makes chromatin accessible because factors are need to get away from it?
Yeah, so we basically did, so we had this really nice system where we could use temperature-sensitive mutants to block cells at different stages of cell cycle. And what we found that H2AZ was dissociated from chromatin during the the anaphase to telophase transition in the cell cycle. And that's when we also see establishment of silencing. So what we think is that H2AZ dissociation from chromatin is a prerequisite to allow establishment of silencing.
What you also looked at was another function of H2AZ in sister chromatid cohesion. So this is kind of in the same area because, yeah, sister chromatids need to get together and then need to be treated during replication and cell division. So what did you find there?
Right. So it's a kind of the follow-up. So because in that study, the genetics paper, we found that these two factors, H2AZ, which is gene HTZ1 in yeast, and the SCC1, they both regulate heterochromatin formation in a similar manner. So that suggested maybe they have they have redundant or maybe regulated functions in common function in regulation of biological processes in the cell. So we focus on cohesion because previous studies have shown that H2AZ is important for chromatin genomic stability. And so we carried out this, assay to look for cohesion defects in cells where we have deletion of H2AZ gene, HTZ1. And indeed, we did see that there was loss of cohesion. So which was, again, surprising, a variant of H2A is H2AZ that is regulating cohesion. And we further went on to find that it was the acetylated form of H2AZ, which was important for regulation of cohesion in the cells. So this was a new function that we identified. And I believe some follow-up work is still probably going on in the lab. So we don't know exact mechanism yet, but it looks like it was because it was regulated by the acetylated form of H2AZ, because if we use mutants of HTZ, which cannot undergo acetylation, we did not see this effect on cohesion.
H2AZ seems to be a very universal player on chromatin, right? It is involved in so many different processes. I mean, it's DNA repair and whatnot, so it's really universal, right? What makes it so special?
That's a good point, and these are histone variants have evolved to have very specialized functions. And so maybe something to do with that. I don't think there was any follow-up work, even from any other labs, as to kind of more better characterization of how H2AZ is regulating all these diverse functions. So I would say we don't know, or at least I don't know at the best of my knowledge, if there are some studies that have come out. Yeah.
So your PhD work was done in yeast. And then to your postdoc, you switched like gears a little bit away from yeast into the mammalian system. And then you worked with Olerando. So was the switch from yeast to mammalian system your choice, or was it simply because the lab did not focus on yeast as a model system?
It's actually, they did focus on yeast. So Ollie's lab has like almost a half and half split in yeast and mouse work. So they've done a lot of these, early seminal studies on nucleosome dynamics using yeast as a model system. So when I finished my PhD and it was time to go for postdoc, I was looking for a lab where I could use my skills learned as a yeast geneticist, but also, learn more skills. And Ollie's lab, when I was interviewing for a project work on yeast, but I said, is it possible to also start learning the mouse? Because that was a very cool project. And I'm really interested in studying, I've learned epigenetic inheritance or establishment of silencing in a single cell level, but I'm really interested in how this epigenetic information is passed down from parents to offspring. And so that was the other project. And of course, he was kind enough to say, you can start on the CIS project and then start learning mouse work and see how that goes. But it turns out that became my main project, and that was very exciting.
Yeah, I think Ollie has probably more projects in his drawer than he could do. So actually, must probably just pick one.
Yeah.
So your first paper out of your postdoc was published straight in Science. There you investigate the mechanisms by which paternal diet affects offspring metabolism, and you kind of touched upon this. So can you talk about the study and also about its impact it had on you and the field?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, this was, maybe I'll go through the whole study. There were many aspects of it. So it's a pretty, I think it could have easily been two papers at least.
Yeah, I mean, it was a science paper, right? So
yeah, exactly. So when I joined Ollie's lab, they had already published a very interesting study where they found that male mice, which are fed a low protein diet, they sire offspring with altered lipid and cholesterol metabolism. So they saw gene expression changes in the liver of the pups and metabolic changes. So the question, and around the same time and following a few years, other studies had also shown that exposure of the male mouse, so the father, to different environments can influence phenotypes in the next generation. What remained a main outstanding question at that time was, what is the mechanism? So how is this information being passed down to the next generation? So when I started in the lab, I focused on small non-coding RNAs because of their well-characterized role in transgenerational inheritance and other model systems. And why it was challenging was we first wanted to know even if there are small RNAs in mature mammalian sperm. Our first goal was to sequence small RNAs from sperm to see if we can find small RNAs, which small RNAs are there. Can they be the epigenetic information carrier to the next generation? And if that means, can they be modulated by the environmental changes such as a low protein diet? And if so, then what is the mechanism? How are they passing down this information to the next generation? So these were kind of the main questions I started off with on my postdoctoral work. And so when we sequenced small RNAs from sperm, surprisingly, we did find a lot of small RNAs. And we found that the most abundant class was these tRNA-derived small RNAs, or tRNA fragments, which are cleavage products of the mature tRNAs. And so that was surprising because usually in any somatic cells, you would see very high abundance of microRNAs, another major class of regulatory small RNAs. So that was interesting. At the same time, or I would say maybe, yeah, when we were doing these studies, a paper came out from Dr. Chichen and colleagues, and they had also found sperm has very high abundance of tRNA fragments. So it wasn't that we were doing something, this was found by other group as well. So we decided to continue following on that. And what was really exciting to us was when we sequenced sperm from low protein animals, we saw that specific tRNA fragments were altered. Their levels were altered. They were upregulated. We also saw specific microRNA was downregulated. So there were basically changes the small RNA profile of sperm was responding to the environmental conditions, which was exciting because at the same time in Ollie's labs, other student was working on looking at whether, you know, DNA methylation undergoes any change in response to low protein diet. And we had not seen any changes there. Similarly, we hadn't seen any changes in histone occupancy in sperm in response to low protein diet. So it was nice that at least small RNAs were changing. So that told us these could be potential carriers of epigenetic information to the next generation. So that's kind of when we started focusing on small RNAs. I focused specifically more on tRNA fragments and A, because they were the ones which were most significantly altered in response to low protein diet, but also because these small RNAs were the most abundant small RNAs in sperm. So if you think about the size of sperm and that of an oocyte, for any small RNA to be functional, it has to be one of the abundant ones. So we focus on tRNA fragments, and we know that they have a connection to the metabolic status as well, because of various modifications. So it kind of made sense to focus on tRNA fragments, and I'm glad we did, because we found very cool things with these tRNA fragments.
And before we go into the functions or what you found, maybe we can quickly focus on what are the tRNA fragments, how are they made? So is this like broken down tRNAs, or are they made some way else?
Yeah, so they could be they were found in many different biological contexts, all, you know, different cells and animals. We have many labs have observed. So they're generated either through pre-tRNA cleavage or cleavage of the mature tRNAs. In sperm, we find tRNA fragments to be mainly derived from mature tRNAs. And so it looks like they are generated from a tRNA getting cleaved. We have done some follow-up work in another study where we were interested in understanding how they're generated in terms of which endonuclease may be responsible. And it looks like it's an RNase A or T2 family endonuclease based on the ends of these fragments when they're generated.
So they are made on purpose.
That's a good question. There are going to be general degradation going on in the cell. But when you look at the tRNA fragments, they have a very specific size. So if it was a kind of a random degradation, and if you align a fragment to a tRNA, you're going to see kind of fragments coming from everywhere, right? But we see very specific size, very specific ends of these fragments. So which tells us even if they're generated in any even if it's a passive degradation, there are processes to regulate or stabilize the tRNA fragments which are present, because we see very specific sizes and also in some cases they don't correlate with the mature tRNA profile of the cell. So that tells us there's some kind of specific stabilization, at least of some tRNA fragments.
Is there any sequence like specificity, or is there any special sequence involved in those RNAs?
So for the cleavage, those RNAs don't have a specificity for the sequence, but for some of them, for the N nucleotides. The problem is that when we sequence tRNA fragments, we're actually sequencing a slightly shorter fragment than what is the first cleavage product. So it looks like there are some you make a cut by the endonuclease, and then there are certain maybe processes or chewing up of the fragment to two or three nucleotides shorter. So we lose the information on the end nucleotide because of that.
Mm. So let's move on to the results.
Yes, yeah. So as we saw that there were changes in the tRNA fragments, so we kind of, you know, and you asked the question of how they're generated. we were interested in also understanding biogenesis in the mature sperm, because that would help us understand the mechanism of how environmental information could be signaled to sperm small RNAs, right? How is it that a low-protein diet is changing small RNA levels in sperm? So we first looked at when those yeast RNA fragments become abundant in sperm. And to our surprise, in the testes, they are not highly abundant. Testes have pi RNAs are the most abundant small RNAs, which have been well characterized by many other groups already. But what was striking was that, so how the male reproductive system is. So you have spermatogenesis, which takes place in the testes. Then sperm enter this long convoluted tubule known as the epididymis, which has the proximal region known as caput and distal region known as cauda. So in mice, sperm spend about 2 weeks in the epididymis. And this is where, sperm become mature and become fertile. So sperm coming into epididymis cannot swim and they cannot fertilize. So it's a very important post-testicular maturation. And then the mature sperm are stored in the cauda epididymis. So when we looked at sperm from all different stages, from testes and caput and cauda epididymis, we found that they had very high abundance of tRNA fragments in the epididymal sperm, but not in the testes. So it looked like as the sperm enter the epididymis, there is a reprogramming of the small RNA payload, where in testes, they're highly abundant in pi RNAs, but in epididymis, the sperm becomes highly abundant in tRNA fragments. So this was very surprising, because sperm, when they are entering the epididymis, at this time, they're transcriptionally silent. So they don't make any new transcripts. So the question was, and not just tRNA fragments, we saw some new microRNAs were also being acquired by sperm. So the question was, how is sperm gaining these tRNA fragments when it's not making any new RNA? And there are two possibilities. One could be they're generated in situ by cleavage of tRNA already present, or the precursor RNAs, or the more kind of exciting possibility, because the mechanistic reasons was that maybe they're generated elsewhere and then shipped to sperm. And so what we followed up on the second possibility, and we did find that the epididymis epithelial cells, which is this, so it's the lumen is where the sperm are swimming and the lining is the epididymis epithelial cells. They have very high abundance of tRNA fragments. And there have been studies at that time which showed that during this epididymal maturation, sperm acquire many new proteins, which are important for sperm maturation. And these proteins are synthesized in the epididymis epithelial cells and delivered to sperm via these small extracellular vesicles secreted by the epithelial cells, known in this tissue as epididymosomes. And these are commonly known as EVs or extracellular vesicles or exosomes. So then we reasoned, because exosomes are known to carry functional RNA, maybe these small RNAs, which are, we see the same RNA, which are highly abundant in sperm, are also highly abundant in the epididymis. These could be shipped from epididymis to sperm via these vesicles. So we purified those vesicles. Indeed, they had very similar small RNA profile as that of sperm. And we could also show in vitro that they can deliver RNA to sperm. So that was one mechanistic way we think there could be changes going on in sperm during epididymal maturation. And this was very important, as I said, for mechanistic purposes, because this gives us a potential mechanism of how environmental information could be delivered to sperm. So maybe epididymis is sensing environment. We don't know how. But then that changes in the epididymis in response to the environment could be delivered to sperm via these extracellular vesicles and thus influence the next generation. So that's kind of where we think currently it could be going on, but we need to do more work, more in vivo. And we had a follow-up paper. We further investigated this as well.
So then the micro or small RNAs have been shown to play a role in like transgenerational inheritance in many organisms, starting with worms, and then going on to also now, as you showed, the mammalian system. So are there any similarities in those mechanisms?
So that's kind of where it's, and maybe I can talk about function more, and then we can get into this question, because that's where the challenge is as to how, because in mammals, for instance, we don't have a, at least yet, identified mechanism of amplifying the small RNA message, which is present in other organisms. So once we saw that, you know, the sperm changes, sperm small RNAs change in response to a low protein diet, the next question was, okay, so there are these changes in small RNAs, but how do they lead to this phenotypes we're seeing in the offspring? And so the reason that maybe sperm delivers these small RNAs to the embryo at the time of fertilization, where they can regulate gene expression, which could maybe then lead to this phenotypes in the adult offspring. So to test that, we use many different ways of manipulating small RNAs in embryos and in mouse embryonic stem cells. So one way is where you can inject small RNAs into a specific small RNA into the embryo, a zygote, and then allow the embryos to grow to, say, 2-cell stage or 4-cell stage, get the embryos and do gene expression analysis, so mRNA-seq transcriptomic analysis. And we did some of those studies, and what we found was that a specific tRNA fragment, tRNA glycine GCC, which is upregulated in response to low protein in sperm, when we alter its level in the embryo, we found that it regulates a very specific set of target genes known as, which are driven by the LTR of an endogenous retroviral element known as MERVEL. And these genes are specifically activated during the 2-cell stage during zygotic genome activation. So that was really intriguing, that a small RNA which is changing in sperm in response to diet changes these very important gene expression profile during early development. So now we don't know how those early changes lead to a metabolic phenotype. And that's, I think, a big question in the field to understand, and something we are trying, and I'm sure many other groups are trying to understand, how early changes would lead to a metabolic phenotype. But kind of going back to your question, the question is, okay, you deliver small RNA, it's going to dilute out very quickly because there's no mechanism of copying that, which is present in other organisms. And so that's why it remains a big question as to how a small change maybe early on is leading to this change later in adult life. It could be that it's changing maybe downstream other epigenetic marks, maybe chromatin, maybe DNA methylation, and that leads to changes later on. Or it could be that early embryonic development is perturbed, where we have evidence for that. And early embryonic development is very important, especially for metabolic health. So if normal placentation takes place, then it's going to be a healthy offspring. But if there are changes, there are defects in placentation that can lead to metabolic disorders as well. So some of it could be due to that, but I would say it's a very speculative model at this time.
Okay. So let's move on a little bit. And finally, and I guess this was already work that has done, maybe it was done in your lab, but I wasn't sure, I couldn't see it from the paper. But you were at least part of a study that generated a single-cell atlas of the murine epididymis. So you can pronounce it much better than me.
Epididymis, yes.
And in the vast difference. So what was the motivation behind the study, and what can it help doing, and what did you learn from that?
Right. So the motivation behind that was to better characterize. So having identified, and this came out from Ollie's lab. I was involved in that during my end of my postdoc, but then I moved on to my current position. So the first author on that, Vera, continued most of this work. So I think she would be the best person to talk about it. But the main motivation behind the study was to better characterize the different cell types in the epididymis, to ask the question of if it is that epididymis plays this role of a sensory organ to the environment, what are the different cell types? What are the regulatory functions between different segments? So epididymis is very interesting in the sense that although it's just one long tubule, a continuous organ, if you look at gene expression profile, you can actually divide it into almost 12 different segments. So we wanted to further characterize if this is even more complex than that, and to do single cell sequencing. And we did identify really interesting new cell types, some immune cell types, which we hadn't first earlier thought that would be there. So it was a study which was motivated to further better understand epididymis, because unfortunately this is kind of the least studied organ, and I think studies were done maybe in 80s. They figure out what it does and kind of that's where it stopped, and some work in the follow-up work has been going on in Ollie's lab by using the information from that single cell sequencing data to identify better key drivers to do some of the studies that we want to do with the epididymis.
So then you moved on to your own lab. And the usual question I now ask would be, if you're writing a grant now, what would you have written into that? But since we wanted to do this interview already 4 months ago, maybe there was something in between that that you worked on or that you already published.
Yeah, so we are currently in the process of publishing some studies, so they're not out yet, but kind of the science paper, and we had a follow up paper in DevCell after that where we further got more in vivo evidence of the soma germline communication between the epididymis and sperm via extracellular vesicles. So in my lab, we are very interested in kind of going back to understanding the mechanistic basis of the soma germline communication. So more specifically, we're focusing on the three major very basic questions. So A, we want to know how these tRNA fragments are generated. As you asked, it's, I think, a very important question. Which endonucleases are responsible? What is the mechanism? How are these tRNA fragments being generated? And so we have some candidate RNases, and where we delete those in mice, and now we see sperm doesn't have a lot of these tRNA fragments. So the follow-up work with that would be to now see if there is sperm which does not have tRNA fragments. Now we expose animals to a different environment. Are we still passing down this environmental information to the next generation or not? So more directly testing the role of these tRNA fragments in epigenetic inheritance. The other direction which we're really interested in is how is that the environmental information, let's say a low protein diet, leads to changes in tRNA fragments. So what is the regulatory connection there? And we're interested in RNA modifications, which could be playing an important role in this. And finally, kind of main question still stays, what are these tons of tRNA fragments doing in sperm and all the other RNA? There are many different small RNA classes there. And so we are really interested in studying the function of tRNA fragments during early development. And with the hope that we can understand why is it that these early gene expression changes lead to these metabolic defects later on. So that's kind of where we are. Hopefully soon we can publish all the work. But that's what we're working on, yeah.
Are you looking for people?
I'm always looking for good people who are interested in this work to join the lab, yes.
Okay. So in the last 33 minutes, we have been on a journey through your scientific career. Did we miss something important, or would you like to add something?
In terms of the science that we've done or anything else?
It's up to you.
I think so. Kind of maybe more to the students who are listening or who would listen to this, I would say, as I mentioned earlier, some of us have very defined paths where we want to go, even scientifically, like I want to work on this project, this field, and this is what I like. But as you will see, journey takes you different ways. I never thought I'd be working with tRNA fragments, sperm, epididymis. I was interested in epigenetic inheritance, and it led me to a very different direction. And that was the fun part of, learning new things and not having this is what I like doing and this is what I'm going to do. So it's good to explore different things, and then they always take you to some interesting new directions. That's kind of maybe what I learned during my scientific journey so far. Yeah.
To finish, could you give us a brief summary of your most important findings?
So I think I'll go back to kind of, that while we haven't figured out the mechanism fully, my postdoctoral work and now from many others, other labs as well, we have found that we can, I would say now there are like more than 100 labs or studies have come out which show that paternal exposure to different environments affects the next generation. So while there has been a lot of skepticism about this, I think it has become more and more clear. One of the important contributions to understanding the mechanism, which my postdoctoral work and which we now continue to do in our lab, was that small RNAs potentially play a role in this. And I think that would be, that to me, I feel like is my most important contribution. And more specifically, that there could be communication between somatic cells and germline, which was kind of the biggest barrier considered for any inheritance of what was called the acquired traits, which is more famously known as the Weissman barrier. So our studies show that there is communication between somatic cells and germ cells. The question is, what's the mechanism? And that's what we're working on currently.
Thank you, Upasana, for your time and for being on the show.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Epigenetics Podcast from ActiveMotif. We hope you enjoyed it. You can find all the mentioned references in the show notes. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. We'd love to hear from you, so please send us your feedback on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or via email at podcast@activemotif.com. And we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. For more great epigenetics content, check out the ActiveMotif blog at activemotif.com/blog. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.